This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Saturday, March 23rd, 2024. I'm Jared Halpern. The Republican House majority keeps getting smaller, with a new threat now facing Speaker Mike Johnson.
Let me walk you through this math here. So it is literally going to be a one-vote margin between April 19th and June 11th.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. The Supreme Court heard arguments in quite a few cases this past week, many of them boiling down to free speech and really what sort of pressure amounts to a violation of the First Amendment.
It's very important that we don't let the government get into the business of censorship, of deciding what's a preferred view or an unpreferred view.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Short-term spending bills and the fights and brinksmanship they produce will be avoided for the next several months. Friday morning, the House overwhelmingly approved what is called an omnibus spending bill. It's a package of several appropriations bills funding federal agencies for the rest of this fiscal year, so through September. As of Friday evening, the Senate was still working out timing agreements to fast-track the measure and avoid a partial government shutdown over the weekend. But the votes are there, and it appears to be a matter of when, not if, the more than $1 trillion package gets final approval. So by the time you are listening to this, it could be a done deal. Still, the vote is opening up some fresh wounds in the House, and it could again test the speakership. Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to vacate, threatening to hold a vote that could oust Speaker Mike Johnson just months after he became Speaker when a Republican revolt led to the removal of Kevin McCarthy. Adding to that pressure, word of another Republican resignation that will shrink even further an already historically slim majority for the GOP. Fox News senior congressional correspondent Chad Pergram is keeping track, as always, of all the chaos.
The general consensus up here is that they're not going to have a government shutdown. They're going to finish this before the deadline here. But you never quite know. And I noticed that Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, he filed cloture, the term of art here, to break a filibuster. And by rule, if you file cloture on a Friday, you can't vote on it until Sunday. That needs 60 votes. You would be able to break the filibuster because, as I said, they had 78 votes in favor of the overall bill to get onto the bill. But then if they run all the traps, that means you might not finish the thing until Monday. What does that mean? A short government shutdown. But they basically did get a deal. They passed this bill in the House of Representatives with way more Democratic votes than Republicans. I think that's significant. They continue to do this over and over and over again. I mean, there were 185 Democratic yeas and only 101 Republican yeas in the House. And that is precisely why Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican representative from Georgia, came out and said, I think it might be time for Mike Johnson to go. Mm-hmm. She has introduced a resolution. It's not hot. It's not live. They don't have to consider it right away to basically remove him from the speakership. This is exactly what happened last fall with Kevin McCarthy. She said
the motion to vacate.
Warning. That's right. This is a pink slip is how she determined it or called it. So now this it doesn't mean that he is going to face that vote. But this is this sort of Damocles that is now lording over Mike Johnson.
I want to talk about that because obviously that, to your point, is going to hang over him as the House is on recess now for a couple of weeks. But before we kind of talk about what's next for Mike Johnson, briefly, let's get into what is in this bill, because I know that was of great consternation to at least some of the right flank of House Republicans. A little bit over $1 trillion for these very important agencies, keeps the government operating through the rest of the fiscal year, so about another 6 months. How much of that spending would have been included in, say, that supplemental package that included aid for Israel, the border, and Ukraine? Anything?
Well, you see, that's something else that Marjorie Taylor Greene had talked about. She said, you know, her previous marker was if he brought that bill up, that she would move to vacate. So that's not being consistent. Now she said, this bill wasn't something that's there. So that would probably, you know, push it over the edge. But I should note to people that, you know, they don't know where they're going to go in Ukraine. Mike Johnson has talked about a Ukraine bill. He's talked about maybe having an Israel bill of some sort. He talked about that right after Chuck Schumer's comments a couple of weeks ago. You know, there's still a couple of different parliamentary options to go around the speaker. And Mike Johnson might like this, actually, because then he doesn't have to weigh in, where you could have what's called a discharge petition. A discharge petition is where you get a solid number of 218 votes in the House. And if you get them to sign this discharge petition, then guess what? You can put your bill on the floor. That's only happened twice in the past quarter century. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think might be more, might have a little more potential, actually, and this gets really technical, but it's important and it's historically important, Jared. It's called defeating the previous question. Now, what does that mean? Now, a lot of times if you're watching C-SPAN before a vote, you'll see them vote on ordering the previous right. question. So that in parliamentary terms, to the guy, you know, watching at home, what that means is you're going to vote in order to have a vote on the underlying yeah. issue.
Basically, and it's so, like a procedural vote to say, let's take up this piece of legislation.
Let's vote to have yeah. the vote on the thing. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like a pre-vote, so to speak. So if you defeat the previous question, the people opposed get control of the floor. Mm. And then you can put anything on the floor you want. And the history of this and why this is historically important is that this is what happened in 1981 with you had Republicans in the House and these moderate to conservative Democrats, the so-called boll weevils, as they were termed at the time, which is a pest in the South. And they were able to pass the Reagan tax cuts. And that's probably the most significant time that they've had a defeat of the previous question. And they get control of the floor. And
so let me understand kind of how this would work then. So in this scenario that you're laying out, there could be, I guess it wouldn't matter what the piece of legislation is, any piece of legislation,
yep.
they defeat the previous question. They say, we're not going to vote on this. Then the anybody who voted for defeating it, so I guess against ordering the previous question.
They prevailed, right?
They would prevail, and then they can put any piece of legislation they see fit onto the floor. So in that scenario, a mix of Republicans and Democrats could say, we're going to put Ukraine and Israel funding on the floor now.
Right. And this is
that's
where
how
Patrick
it would work?
McHenry. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
And what you would do first is you've written this, you would have a rule that you would put first. And so then if you adopt the rule, then you get to debate the bill and then you have to approve the bill. So there's a couple other steps there. But yes, in short, that's what it would be. And it's so rare to do this. This is why Patrick McHenry, the congressman from North Carolina who's leaving on CBS, he said that this is kind of like nuclear war. And the reason that members are loath to sign this is because they interpret it as beating up on the leadership here and not being consistent.
Yeah, I mean, you're going over your own speaker's head.
Right, but and the people who want to do that type of thing right now are not the people who are for aid to Ukraine.
Right.
You know, this is the Freedom Caucus. So it's a weird combination of things. So, yeah, that's why that's only been successful once since 1981. That was in 1988. So this does not happen very often. But I will say this, Jared. We are in a very, very strange period right now. And so strange things like that could happen. And if there's going to be a path, maybe to pass that bill, one of those two options might be on the table.
Well, and to that point, because Friday afternoon was just, crazy in Washington and specifically in the House of Representatives, because there was another Republican, Mike Gallagher, kind of once viewed as a young up and coming Republican. I think he's 40 years old out of Wisconsin, has been chairing that China committee that's looking into China's influence in the United States. He says he's going to leave early. Next month,
mid-April. That's right.
So when he steps aside in mid-April, that leaves the margin of error for House Republicans a single vote.
It's pretty bad, and here's why. You have Ken Buck, who is stepping down at the end of the week. Okay. Then what will happen at some point, you have Mike Gallagher, who is stepping down. Then the Democrats, there is a special election in Western New York for the seat of Brian Higgins, who resigned.
Democrats are
That's
expected
a Democratic
to win.
Seat. That's right. So it gets even more narrow. And this is the tightest the numbers have ever been in the House of Representatives. I mean, Mike Johnson said the other day, after Buck leaves, it's at 1.16% is the difference there. And then it's going to get more narrow with Gallagher departure, and also then with the if the Democrats win the seat there. There might be a little bit of help on the way if Republicans win this seat in California for Kevin McCarthy's seat. There's a runoff for that seat. That'll happen, and that'll go back toward the Republicans, obviously. But that's not going to be until later this year. And what we're looking at, though, is just so many members are so disgusted with what's going on here, certainly on the Republican side, passing bills with Democratic majorities, big majorities, actually. And this is where Pete Aguilar, who was the chair of the Democratic caucus, he said a couple of days ago, he said that Hakeem Jeffries is not the Speaker of the House, but he is the leader of the Congress. And he's right.
So you and I have talked about this dynamic. I remember, you know, when McCarthy was ousted, you and I kind of talked about, you know, is it possible that there is a scenario in which Jeffries becomes Speaker, or there's a kind of consensus Speaker? And you had talked about how, you know, that's nothing like that has ever happened before.
The House has never flipped in the middle of Congress. The Senate has, but not the House.
Do you think we're any closer to making history on that?
Remember what I said a few minutes ago about weird things happening up there?
That's what I'm saying, man.
No, and you always hear what I say. It's all about the math, and it absolutely is. And so let me kind of
the math is subtracting. There's a lot of subtraction going on.
Let me walk you through this math here. So it is literally going to be a one vote margin.
Yeah.
Between April 19th and June 11th. But there's actually a couple more seats that are there because you lose one, but there's three seats. You know, there's a three seat difference. So you still have to have several other people quit. And it has been presented to me, and maybe this timetable is being accelerated here, that you could have people leave before maybe after the midterms, in other words, the lame duck Congress, and then you have to elect a speaker, and it would probably be Hakeem Jeffries, frankly. That could be very strange. You could just have this happen now because people up here, I've never seen so many members who are so upset and so disgusted and so frustrated. And so if you have the opportunity to go home early, you have the opportunity to get a decent paycheck off of Capitol Hill, there are some people who might do that. So you might have history made here where you have, the House flip in the middle of the Congress. That is certainly on the radar screen right now.
So that leads us to where we started in this motion to vacate, or at least a notice of an intent, whatever we're calling it, for this motion to vacate from Marjorie Taylor Greene. I know she has kind of talked about it in views of kind of a warning shot to the Speaker after this omnibus spending package was passed. One of the criticisms that Kevin McCarthy leveled against Democrats was that they could have prevented this chaos in the House, that, you know, he kind of blamed the eight Republicans who voted for his dismissal for siding with Democrats. That dynamic still exists. Would Democrats feel differently about doing this again, ousting Mike Johnson? Or maybe are there some Democrats out there that are going to say, listen, we don't need to go through this. Let's just keep them here for a few more months, see how the midterm elections go.
It's unclear because you might have Democrats who maybe say they support Mike Johnson because it actually helps them, moderate Democrats. They might, you know, be willing to do that. It's a different environment now where Democrats might say, ooh, you know, if there's a couple more retirements, maybe we get the chance to flip the House, okay, right now. So they might be unwilling to do that. I mean, you know, it causes chaos. I mean, let me just present a scenario, and this is just me, you know, reading between the lines here. Maybe they do have a vote to vacate and there's no speaker, and Democrats are like, and then people just start quitting because they're like, we've been through this once before. This has never happened. And so we are out of here. And Democrats get the majority then. Something. I mean, I could see that. It's unknown. The bottom line was this, is that Kevin McCarthy, I've talked about how Republicans, most of them, maybe with the exception of Marjorie Taylor Greene, are willing to give him deference. And they don't like what's going on, but they're willing to say, OK, he's fighting as good a fight as possible, and we're not going to move to vacate.
And I've heard some Republicans say that he kind of inherited this, that he didn't create this.
Right. And even Marjorie Taylor Greene, by not making her resolution hot, that kind of reflects that type of thinking here, too, Jared. But here's the other thing. It's not so much that they like, and I'm talking about Democrats right now. It's not so much that that you have Democrats who like Mike Johnson more. I think they view him as earnest and trustworthy, and he's demonstrated that in negotiating these bills, just not because Democrats have gotten some of the things they wanted, but they're like, yeah, this is what we negotiated, and it was negotiated in good faith, and it was fair. But it's just that they did not like Kevin McCarthy. And that's the same problem that was going on in the Republic. They didn't like him. And that's why I always kind of have viewed him as an accidental speaker. He didn't become the Speaker of the House in 2015 when John Boehner went away. Mm-hmm. He was right there on the precipice. He was the majority leader because members were looking for reasons to vote against him because they just did not like him. And I'll tell you what, the whole story about Kevin McCarthy is played out in this spending bill. And here's why. Go back to last spring, Jared, and they were dealing with the debt ceiling. And so there was an agreement between McCarthy's team and the White House on the debt ceiling. And they agreed to a spending level for funding the government in the fall. And then what Kevin McCarthy did was he told members of the Appropriations Committee to go and write the bills at lower levels that were not reflective of the debt ceiling agreement.
Right.
Okay. And so people immediately started to see Kevin McCarthy talking out of both sides of his mouth because he had promised all sorts of different things that were not consistent to all sorts of different people. Then we get to the fall, and because the bills aren't done because they were written to the other level and not the debt ceiling level, and that is still being borne out here in late March because of the decision made by Kevin McCarthy last spring to try to protect himself politically by saying, okay, I'm going to agree with a debt ceiling agreement here that I don't really want to, but I know that's good government. I'm going to get smoked inside of my conference, which happened. And then I'm going to write the spending bills to a lower level. And then that helped him a little bit, but not enough to save his hide in the fall. And that's why we are dealing with a potential government shutdown in March. Jared, they have never started a government shutdown before the 18th of January. And here we are potentially staring at one in late March, almost 2 months on.
Although, albeit probably if there is one, a very short-lived
abbreviated.
Right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it would,
absolutely.
The latest this could kind of go out would be kind of what, midday Monday?
Like I said, Monday probably, yeah. And it's probably not even going to go to
But listen,
that
what's happening in the House and how this spending bill now kind of sets the stage for governance for the next 6 months is remarkable because, to your point, we have now these resignations. You have this warning to Mike Johnson. It might embolden Democrats. Does it move forward? Does it make it more likely, less likely that Ukraine aid gets done?
Well, that's where I talk about those two scenarios with the discharge petition and moving the previous question. I think that puts that more on the table now. I wrote a piece about this, a blog a couple of days ago, explaining this process. It's pretty arcane.
Or is there?
I
would say, or is that like the leverage that Johnson has? Johnson maybe gets Democrats to not go along with this by putting something like that on the floor.
Maybe. I just know one thing, that there are so many options out there for Mike Johnson, and none of them are good. That's the problem. And again, that's why the Democrats, if they can just pluck off enough Republicans, because you might also have, as a counter to Marjorie Taylor Greene, some Republicans who are interested in funding Ukraine and, quote, you know, government making sure the trains run on time, say, look, okay, it's obvious that getting on this band of the people who are trying to impeach Mayorkas and do all this other stuff, one of the reasons Ken Buck announced his resignation because he didn't agree with the impeachment of Mayorkas. By the way, that trial hasn't started yet in the Senate. That's a whole other story, by the way, Jared. But anyway, but that's why people might say, okay, yes, we'll vote for the Ukraine stuff. Because really, the only things they have to do the rest of the year after this is fund the government in September. Oh, and by the way, Kay Granger, the chair of the Appropriations Committee, who is leaving at the end of this Congress, announced seconds after they passed the bill that she is stepping down this Congress as the chair of the Appropriations Committee because she doesn't want to go through this melee in the fall to keep the government open.
And it'll be fascinating to see who gets that, because that may be, other than Speaker of the House, is the most important position in government.
And certainly as you go toward funding the government in the fall.
Yeah.
I mean, we could have the House flip. And again, it might be a moot point if the House flips. I mean, then you have Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, who's the chair of the Appropriations Committee. So, maybe we shouldn't spend much time on trying to figure out who's the chair on the Republican side, because maybe this will all change. I don't know.
Well, thanks for joining me on what I know has been a really slow spring Friday for you.
Yeah, really just cruising along here.
All right. Have a good weekend if you have one, Chad.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.
The Supreme Court heard a number of arguments this week, including several First Amendment and speech-related cases. One case involved the NRA, after a New York state financial official was accused of pressuring insurance companies to cut ties with the gun lobbying group. An attorney for the state official said she was just doing her job, going after insurance policies that were illegal under state law, but even justices on the more liberal wing of the court, like Sonia Sotomayor, sounded skeptical.
What she was seeking was a ban even of potentially lawful affinity programs.
In another First Amendment case, Sylvia Gonzalez said after winning a city council seat in a Texas town, she drew up a petition to push out the city manager. After a meeting, she tucked the petition back into her pile of paperwork. And the mayor, who was friends with that city manager, said that was theft of government property. That also drew some skepticism from justices across the spectrum, as attorneys for the mayor and city said, hey, that was a legitimate crime. Justice Neil Gorsuch asked them,
how many statutes are there on the books these days, many of which are hardly ever enforced? Last I read, there were over 300,000 federal crimes, counting statutes and regulations. I can't imagine how many there are at the state and local level. And you're saying they can all sit there unused, except for one person who alleges that I was the only person in America who's ever been prosecuted for this because I dared express a view protected by the First Amendment, and that's not actionable.
But the 1A week began with a case called Murthy v. Missouri. Lower courts had sided with state officials who said the Biden administration went too far in telling social media companies what posts to take down or restrict and what was disinformation. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asked,
your view, has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways in the most important time periods? The government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country, and the government encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information.
So did federal officials violate the First Amendment by coercing or significantly encouraging content moderation decisions?
So this first case about whether social media companies had been cooperating with the government to suppress dissenting views about COVID and so on, it's a hard question.
John Yu is a professor at UC Berkeley Law School.
I think if you were just guessing from the oral arguments, the justices aren't persuaded yet. I'm not saying they never will be persuaded, but right now they want to see some evidence that the government, the Biden administration here, actually coerced social media companies to take down posts from people like Jay Bhattacharya or Scott Atlas, people actually who I think have turned out to be right about the harm, massive harm that lockdowns were doing. And so the problem for the court, based on the questions, was, yes, we see all these emails and texts where the Biden administration is saying, take down this post, take down that post. What we don't see is, what did the government threaten to do to the social media companies if they didn't comply?
One of the questions I heard, and I forget which justice posited this, it might have been Justice Alito, who said, before social media platforms, do you think this kind of thing would be occurring? Governments calling up, you know, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and actually two justices who did work at the White House, Justices Kagan and Kavanaugh, said absolutely, it was normal practice before social media existed to call up reporters and publications and basically get mad at them and tell them that they'd published something inaccurate. Do you think that those justices' lived experiences in White Houses actually is a solid or significant influence here?
Yes, I think it is, because in fact, you have a number of the justices, including Justice Alito himself, who served in the executive branch of government. So they're familiar with the idea that people in the government might call New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Fox News and say, hey, we don't like that story you've published. We think it's wrong, or you're hurting the country. Can you please take it down? Nobody, I think, in this case says government can't do that. What makes a difference is if the government then says, and if you don't take it down, well, you know, we know that, you know, we could always sick the Justice Department on you to see whether you should be allowed to buy that company you want to buy. That's the part, not the speaking to the press, not trying to persuade people to write a different kind of story, but the next step. Nice little social media platform you've got here. It'd be shame if something happened to it.
Oh, that was a very clever line. And that's very pertinent.
I wish I could say I invented it.
It's very pertinent to the conversation, right? Because it's something we've, it's like a very meme-ish type language, which sort of intersects with my next question. And that is, you know, you're saying there's a line, right? There's a line that has to do with threatening. But is there also a line, and I don't know if it's being considered here, maybe it would require a different case, that we're determining or we're saying what should be published, what is disinformation, especially in a time of COVID, a time where things were so fraught. And as you just noted, some of those people who had their things taken down, who were humiliated, who lost their followings, who were criticized as being liars, they ended up being right. Is there a line there?
It's very important that we don't let the government get into the business of censorship, of deciding what's a preferred view or an unpreferred view. Now, the government, I think, sometimes takes us too far, as the Biden administration here did, where they say, we know the right answer. And so we have an interest in driving off what they call disinformation, which might, in the end, because that's how science works. In fact, that's how law works, is you allow and have dissenting critical voices. Sometimes those voices are the ones that turn out to be right. And so that's another question, which I don't think this case will get into, which is we really should sit and question whether we want the government in the age of social media, where it is so easy to go to just a few companies and put a chokehold or a bottleneck onto public discourse, whether we want the government to be going out there and deciding what's the preferred view and what's the unpreferred view, what the capital T, capital S, the science says is the right answer. When we all know actually that science, like any other kind of inquiry, depends on critical views, on discussion and debate, and then the possibility of changing your mind.
I think also it's curious to see it happening right now as lawmaker after lawmaker holds hearing after hearing about regulating social media, about Section 230, about liability protections and whatnot, and protecting kids online. And yet nothing has been passed. Nothing has been done to rein in or regulate social media companies. And this sort of access or back and forth that government has with social media companies in light of a failure to pass any legislation, does that look weird?
Actually, what you've mentioned about the lack of action in Congress and the agencies, plus the very generous immunity that the social media companies have under Section 230, gives you a good reason why the states might win. Because if you were the social media companies, put yourself in that position, maybe you don't need the government to have an explicit threat on the table, because they know that the government could always ruin the party for you if they decided to change how they're going to enforce Section 230, or Congress is going to ask Congress to change Section 230, or bring all kinds of enforcement actions against you, which the Biden administration could choose to do. You know, it's not a coincidental. The Justice Department just announced a massive antitrust investigation into Apple.
Yeah.
Right? They're showing the things they can do to the technology companies if they want to. So if you're, you know, the CEO of Apple, the CEO of Facebook or Google, you will do what the government asks of you, even if they don't have to say explicitly all the things that the government can do.
Okay, just a couple more for you. Another First Amendment case we heard about this week had to do with another kind of pressure. In this case, it involved the NRA. A New York Department of Financial Services employee was accused of pressuring insurance companies to stop doing business with the NRA or to stop doing yes. business with those who are endorsed by the NRA, and how far the state official went in threatening companies. It seems like even the justices, more liberal members, were a bit concerned here with this 1A case and involving the NRA and siding with the NRA.
Yes, this case, in a way, has the same element to it that the social media case has, the idea of the government intervening into private markets, private networks, and trying to play favorites with different points of view, with the implicit threat behind it of government action against you if you don't cooperate. So there's two things going on. One is we should be concerned about speech, the right of the NRA to speak its mind about the Second Amendment, just like we have the right of Dr. Jay Bhattacharya or Dr. Scott Atlas to question the COVID lockdowns. The other thing these cases bring forward is how vast the power of the government truly is now. You want to talk about Letitia James going after Donald Trump and winning a $350 million judgment. If you see that and you're in New York and you're a bank and the attorney general says, you really sure you want to have the NRA as a client at your bank? What are you going to do? I don't think you're going to keep the NRA as your client, because the power of the government, of these attorney generals or of the Justice Department, has become so all-encompassing that's easy for them to retaliate against social media companies or banks that don't want to cooperate with them.
Okay, finally, on the First Amendment cases, John, this one seemed a little bit more tricky. Sylvia Gonzalez won a city council seat in Castle Heights, Texas, after which she drafted a petition, and this was a few years back, she drafted a petition to have the city manager pushed out. Well, that city manager was friends with the mayor, and after she put this petition that she drafted back into her own possessions after a council meeting, the mayor said, oh, look, she stole government property, and she was arrested. She says, this is obvious. I was punished for my speech, for my petition that I drafted. But it's actually not so cut and dry, right? This is actually, if she did in fact do something wrong, or that is actually breaking the law, the justices were actually focused on that.
So I think it's, you know, without a doubt wrong what the city and city managers did to her. The question in that case is really a narrow one, which is, what kind of justice does she get? Can she actually get money? Or can she just have an order from the court telling them to stop? Can she get some kind of disciplinary procedure undertaken against them? So I think that case actually in the end might just turn narrowly on, look, there's no doubt that her rights were violated. The government was retaliating against her. But is she allowed to get money from those people? Usually the courts, the Supreme Court, most of all, is very leery of saying that the personal pockets of government officials are on the line, because what they're worried about is not these jokers who are obviously breaking the law here, but they're worried about the police officer or the firefighter who has to make a snap decision on the street and then getting sued for money, you know, which could destroy their livelihoods, maybe because someone doesn't agree with the choices they made afterwards.
One more question before I let you go, because this was not a set argument, but we did hear from the Supreme Court very briefly on this Texas law, SB4. There was this lot of legal back and forth, Fifth Circuit, then to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had blocked this law, and then they said, no, it can be enacted or enforced, rather, while the legal case plays out. And then a different panel of the Fifth Circuit said, you know what, we're actually going to put the whole thing on hold again. This SB4 law is about enforcing immigration law, but rather enforcing a state immigration law that makes illegal immigration, that makes being undocumented in Texas a misdemeanor punishable by jail. State judges would have the authority to order you deported, and local law enforcement would then drive you to the border, it sounds like. There is some lingering confusion about how this would actually be carried out, it sounds like, if you listen to the Fifth Circuit arguments. But I'm just wondering, haven't we gone over this? Is this not under federal? Is immigration law not under federal jurisdiction? Even if the federal jurisdiction is, we don't want to enforce any border laws. Like, what do the what can a state do?
So first, all the stuff that involved the Supreme Court, I think people have misunderstood what was happening, because what was going on at the court was the Supreme Court was really a fight about how quickly should they intervene in a case. Because this dispute between Texas and the U.S. is moving its way up from the trial judge who found the law the Texas law unconstitutional, to, as you said, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And basically, the Biden administration wanted to leapfrog the Court of Appeals and go right to the Supreme Court. And so what the Supreme Court just said is, no, we're sending it back down there and let it take the normal course. In fact, if you remember, this is exactly what they did when Special Counsel Jack Smith tried to rush to the Supreme Court. And again, the Supreme Court said, no, the regular mechanism of justice is going to operate. And that's what that's all it did here. It didn't really, the Supreme Court didn't take a view on the law in question. Now, I have to say that the Texas law under existing Supreme Court precedent, I think, is almost certainly unconstitutional. Because the Supreme Court has said, Arizona passed a law very much like this about 10 years ago.
SB 1070.
And the Supreme Court, and Arizona versus United States. And the Supreme Court struck it down. And it said, unlike most other areas, immigration is one of those few questions where the federal government has complete authority. States are not allowed to participate at all in immigration matters, even to the point of trying to help the federal government, not to mention being an obstacle to the federal government. And so this case will ultimately turn on whether this new Supreme Court, with a very different membership than that one 10 years ago, chooses to reverse Arizona. I will point out that the Arizona case, the more conservative justices were in dissent. So I could easily see this Supreme Court, after the Fifth Circuit is done, taking the case and then perhaps finding for Texas.
Interesting. And Texas, I mean, they did a number of things, right? Like the Lone Star operation. They've built some sections of wall. They've deployed their own state troopers to sort of assist Border Patrol. There are things a state can do, but you're saying this law in particular might have gone too far.
Actually, if you read Arizona closely, it suggests that Texas is not allowed to do anything about immigration. Now, once illegal aliens are in the state and they commit a crime under Texas law, for example, they commit robbery or trespassing, then they're just subject to Texas law like anybody else. But under the Arizona precedent, Texas is not allowed to have the barbed wire there along the Rio Grande. Right. They're not allowed to have their own border patrol. They're not allowed to try to catch illegal aliens. It's hard to actually realize in Arizona how complete and sweeping federal power is over the border and over immigration. But I think that's why it went so far, I think, is why this court is probably willing to re-examine it and try to find a better balance between the federal right over immigration, over what states are allowed to do.
You know, you're reminding me actually that what states can do is deploy their National Guard if they want to backstop Border Patrol in a non-law enforcement capacity, but in a more administrative capacity. That's been something that's been relied upon since SB 1070's decision.
Yes, and the other thing that's interesting here is Texas does have a new argument that wasn't raised in the Arizona case, which is either the level of illegal migration or the kinds of groups involved with it are such a threat to the security of a state like Texas that it has a right of self-defense, which is recognized in the Constitution, that states do have some kind of right of self-defense. The question is really whether this movement of illegal aliens is invasion. I mean, that's what the Constitution requires, either an invasion or an imminent danger that triggers a state's right to self-defense. Otherwise, the federal government still has, the predominant authority over the border, over war, over foreign affairs. And so we'd have to see whether the court is willing to entertain the idea that the movement of 2 to 3 million illegal aliens a year across the border represents an invasion of some kind.
John Yu, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
That'll do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Tomorrow, White House National Security Council advisor John Kirby joins us to talk about the war in Gaza and Israel's plan to send a delegation to the White House next week. And former campaign advisor to President George W. Bush, Karl Rove, joins us to talk about what goes into picking a vice presidential running mate. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. The Will Kane Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Kane as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.